Hello, and welcome back to Fishnets and Philosophy. Forgive me if I sound a bit hoarse. I found out this morning that I have COVID, so yay for me. We're taking a little break from my current Why Horror series with a bonus episode where I have a guest or guests plural on to talk about a specific film or films. New thing I'm doing, so let's roll with it, people. All right, so this episode we are going to bring things down a bit emotionally just to match with my own mood. We're going to talk about Eden Lake, directed by James Watkins from 2008, and then and Speak No Evil from Christian Turfdup from 2022. All right, so this week I am joined by the brilliant Alice Boyd-Leslie from the Drunken Horror Podcast and Rebecca McCallum, Ghouls Extraordinaire, and also the new host of the new Talking Hitch podcast. So before we jump into the discussion, Alice, if you could just kind of let me know a little bit about yourself and horror, and then I'll move on to yourself, Rebecca, and then we'll jump in.
Hello, thank you so much for having me back. It's been a while. I host a podcast called Drunken Horror with two other lovely co-hosts, and we chat about horror movies and get a little bit drunk whilst we do it. And we tend to bring a guest on for some episodes as well to talk about one of their favourite horror movies or a movie that they want to talk about. And we keep it nice and chilled. We want to have that kind of vibe that you're at the pub with your friends and you're drinking and talking about movies, because that is some of my favorite pastimes. So it's great fun. Yeah, it's nice to be doing something kind of film related, from kind of studying film from a younger age and always being into films. And then now I decided to do this podcast for a little over a year now. So it's great fun to kind of be doing something.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And thanks for coming back onto the pod. It's exciting to have you back. And yeah, so Rebecca, if you could just introduce yourself as well and kind of, yeah, big yourself up, and then we'll jump into the films.
Yes, thank you as well for having me back. It feels like we're always on political territory, me and you, Belle. The last time it was The Purge, and here we are, Eden Lake. We keep it light, so we keep it light. Exactly. Yeah, so my name is Rebecca. I'm assistant editor at Ghouls Magazine. I'm senior contributor at Moving Pictures Film Club. I am a writer, editor, author, and as you said, I've now recently just launched a Hitchcock podcast that explores all my obsessions and ideas about Hitchcock, his films, and the world around them.
Amazing. And excuse me, I am excited to start listening and jumping into that podcast as well, because yeah, just as a brief mini tangent, like, Hitchcock is one of those directors that I only know the big hits, and that's kind of about it. So I'm excited to kind of discover more from someone who loves his stuff, so it's going to be fun. So yes, and
thank you,
my listeners, follow along that, yeah, jump in. Perfect. Okay, but thank you so much to both of you. So as I said, we're going to be talking Eden Lake and Speak No Evil. I'm going to kick things off straight out of the blocks with Eden Lake. For myself, this was a film which I only discovered for the first time this year, had never kind of even heard of it before. And it was just like on Twitter, there was like some kind of random Twitter thread, which was like, you know, what was the most disturbing horror film you saw or something like that. And there was loads of ones thrown out, and Eden Lake kind of popped up a bit. And I was like, OK, I'll have to check this one out. And it also has Michael Fassbender. So, you know, what's not to like there? And yeah, then I watched it and I felt unclean, and I still feel unclean. So that's my own experience. I'll lean in. So yeah, both yourselves. Which was your experience with this film, your general thoughts before we jump into dissecting it? I'll jump into Rebecca first.
Let me at it, Belle. Let me at it.
The reins are off.
Go. The reins are off. This is my therapy now. All the girls who listen will be... They got a warning from me before I came on this evening. But yes, this is, in all seriousness, it's a very... As a working class person whose working class identity is very important to who they are, this film is a very hard watch for me. And whenever I say that, people assume I'm talking about the horror. It's absolutely not the case. I'm sure we'll get into it, but you know, there's a lot to unpack here, and a lot around like social context and social responsibility in terms of messaging in film. So I'm really looking forward to getting all that off my chest.
Brilliant. Amazing. And for yourself, Alice, what's kind of your general kind of experience with the film?
So this was a first time watch for me as well. And it'd been a kind of, it's a poster that I've seen everywhere, and I've never really been that interested in watching it, but I thought I'd give it a go. And yeah, pretty much everything you were saying, Rebecca, I was like, what is this film? Yeah. I'm sure we'll get into it. I'm not going to say much more.
There's definitely lots of thoughts to be had, and it's one of those ones where it's kind of like, if I just, you know, you could just talk and talk nonstop, and it's kind of like, you know, I need to do some bit of punctuating the conversation to stream the narrative. Not that I care, actually, but my listeners might.
Exactly,
but it was fun when I was looking up like the research for the film and the research for the pod. Like, I was like, I just wanted to, like, you know, because I was watching the film, like the first time I watched it, it was one of those ones that just like, a month after seeing it, it was still in my brain. I couldn't get it out. It was just there, like this weird kind of like presence lurking on my over my shoulders or something. I just couldn't get rid of it. And then I rewatched it for this pod. I watched it on Monday, and rewatching it, most of my thoughts kind of stayed the same. Some of them kind of like noticed maybe more nuanced things that I didn't the first time. But the entire time I was watching it, I was just like Googling the director, because I was just like, I just want to see that it somewhere it shows that he's gone to some like school like Eton or something like that, and he's this like rich posh boy who's just decided to make a film. But I couldn't find anything in his background. And hey, James Watkins, if that's not you, my apologies. You know, but it just, you get that feeling that this is made by someone who is viewing another class, another part of society from an outsider's lens, and I can't remove that while watching it. Like there's the entire time watching it, there was no sense of, oh, this was made from a sympathetic or empathetic lens. I didn't get that at all. So I want to know what both of you think about that, your kind of, I guess, emotional experiences watching it.
Well, and it was the first.
Go, Rebecca.
I'm just like chomping at the bit.
Go for it.
So, listeners, I was saying to Alison and Belle off mic that I've meditated before this podcast, so you know, I'm hopefully going to come to it with a sense of calm. It being a number of years since I first saw this at the cinema, and I remember then feeling like the ground had just dropped from beneath me, and had to go to the pub straight away to just
to process.
Just to process, to reconcile, just to be with people. And then in watching it for this podcast, I think I'd always had my feelings about it, but then coming to it again for the podcast, I think I'd almost downplayed in my head exactly the impact that it had on me. And seeing it again in 2023, I think having that time gap between, I think this is 2008, this film. Yeah, so having that time gap between 2008 when it was released and coming to it in 2023 for me, it just heightened all those initial feelings that I had. And I think, especially when you consider what we've been through politically, you know, in our journey through like the EU and, you know, Corbyn and all these like losses that we've had. And now we're in, you know, recessions and cost of living crises. So, you know, as a working class, we are squashed down more than ever. So I'm coming to it with all that baggage now as well. And for me, it's like, you know, there's two types of negative representation of the working class in film. There's one where they're laughed at and they're made fun of. And then there's another where it's like they're a figure to be feared. And in this film is definitely employing the latter. And I think a lot of it, actually on reflection, the style of this film is almost, it's very almost like documentarian, isn't it? It feels like, do you know, it reminds me of like a reconstruction, you know, when you watch like true crime, which I think feeds in to people feeling more attached to it. And I think that makes it doubly dangerous because people read it almost as being quite realistic. So I had a huge emotional response to this film. And I think, you know, if we look at the social context underneath it as well, you know, at that time we had David Cameron and the whole hug a hoodie speech. We were in like a broken Britain, and we've got politicians employing that othering, you know, which I see is a device that's used in this film with the kids and with the parents as well. You know, society always needs an other, and here it's the working class, you know. So it's a case of, well, if they can't understand us, then they just monsterize us. And then you've got, obviously, well, you spoke at the top, Bella, about the director and what position he might be coming from. I don't know his background because it was very hard to find information on him. But you know, regardless of his background, one thing that I really feel is being utilized here is an exploitation of like a zeitgeist moment. So it's jumping on a bandwagon of demonizing the working class and using that for entertainment, which to me is really, it's disgusting. You know, at the top of the film, there is mention of the respect agenda. And that was something that was brought in by Tony Blair in 2005, you know, and he spoke then about putting law-abiding majority back in charge of communities. And we had the ASBOs and things like that, you know, and the things that he would talk about, the crimes, are things like spitting at old ladies, graffiti, vandalism, all very targeted working at the working class, you know. And this, I think it's just that the film really plays into this idea of problem families and chaotic families and families who lack infrastructure, you know. And it feels like the language of people like Blair at the time and Cameron, you know, that language feels reflected cinematically in this film, you know. And it's riding on the coattails, if you like, of what I see as a takedown of the working class.
100, that's, everything is there just so eloquent. Me and myself and Alice just nodding along. Like, I don't even know if there's anything else to add. I love the contrast that, like, you know, the two of you coming onto this are coming from different perspectives. And that for yourself, Alice, it's the first time watching, for yourself, Rebecca, it's something that you've had percolating for a long time and you have this connection to it. But for yourself then, when you were watching it, what was kind of like your overall, I guess, emotional takeaway from it then? Like, very similar, I guess, to what like Rebecca's feelings are.
Yeah, I mean, very similar. I mean, I was going into it expecting something way more kind of like emotional, full of more emotionally turmoil, as like say Speak No Evil is, like that is a movie that really affected me. But with this, I was like, I actually don't care about the two main characters. And I wouldn't say I'm necessarily on the side of the kids, because the way of their how they've been represented is awful. But I was a bit like, oh, like, I don't understand. Like, I thought that the horror and how people have been emotionally affected by it is the kind of the torture and what happens to these people. But because I didn't care about them, I was like, okay, so this hasn't really like affected me. And then I was like, it's actually this representation of this town, like everyone in this town, and especially like the kids and their families, the bits of the families that we see them, because it is like if Daily Mail wrote a movie about the working class, like it's like exactly it. Like, and there's just so many moments where like that you can just imagine a middle class person saying to a working class like person, saying like the moment when Michael Fassbender's character yes. says like, "Oh, you've got Ray-Bans," like, and it's like just like I know that he did actually steal them, but just that instant, like, just presume that like no, this person couldn't ever have Ray-Bans because look at where they're from, like, and it's like there's loads of little moments yeah. like that. That's just awful.
Yeah, no, 100%. And like, it's and I want to know what both of you like think about this from watching it. Cause like, for me, like the first time I watched it, like, I think there was just so many emotions that I just couldn't really put them in order. Like, there was just a general unclean feeling. And then the second time rewatching it, like, you know, coming into it, knowing what I was in for, I was kind of like, you know, I had like a different slightly different perspective. Like, I was prepared for the onslaught of what was going to be in the terrible kind of representation. But rewatching it, I kind of, and I don't know if maybe this is just my reading of it, but I kind of don't think we're actually supposed to be on the main character's side. Like, rewatching it, I kind of thought that the film is perhaps in a very lazy and reductive way trying to put across this message of kind of everyone's kind of shit, like people are shit. Like, I think that's possibly what maybe was trying to happen, because like a lot of it kind of similar to kind of the instances like when we'll touch on it later with Speak No Evil, there's so many moments of it's just misread social cues and shit like that. And I think there's a lot of moments of that in this build-up of Eden Lake. There's just moments of like misread social cues. There's just kind of people are just, because they're coming at it from different perspectives, they're just not able to kind of see the other person's perspective, and there's a bit of like, you know, standoffishness, but there's no problems. It's only then once the main character, who you're supposed to be on his side, but I don't really think so, but he's the one that kicks it all off by just going into the home, like unprovoked unprovoked, just goes into the home. And it's all goes downhill from there. Like, so I'm just kind of like,
yeah,
you know, and like you kind of had a bit of a dick move. Yeah. But I want to know what you kind of think about that. Is like, that is my reading of that perhaps like, you know, too kind to the film, maybe, that like, or is, you know, do you think there's an element there that maybe we aren't actually supposed to be on anyone's side at all? Like, I want to know what you think about that.
I mean, it's hard to tell really, because I can totally imagine someone from a kind of middle class background being like, I would definitely go into the house and I would go and speak to the father and tell them that, you know, they left some broken glass and then I had to replace my tire. It's like, there's so many instances where I'm like, just leave it and just go home. Like, mm-hmm. it's fine. So it's difficult to say, really. I think in some ways you are kind of meant to be on rooting a little bit for the two main characters. I can't really see it being a kind of a neutral film, really. But I guess it depends on like what angle you're looking at it from, really, and the type of person who's watching it. Because yeah, like I said, I can imagine there are people who would be on their side and think like, oh, how awful for them, even though they also did terrible things. You know, Jenny killed the kid, like mm-hmm. the kid that was going to go and like help her. So, you know, they've done awful things. But yeah, I don't know. I'm rambling a little
bit. No, it's perfect. And before I bring you in on that kind of point, Rebecca, I kind of think as well, when you're watching it, it's like, the representation of the kids and that general community is so ugly. Like, it's not like, it doesn't feel like a fair representation. Like, I can't, and whereas I think the representation of like, you know, the two main characters, that you can pick we all know people like that, like you can picture them, you know, so that kind of felt real, whereas the other ones were a heightened kind of cartoon version of villainy. And it's just like, yeah, it feels like it's trying to do some things, but then it's not approaching it from the right way. I'm not sure. Like, I do think underneath it all, there is a message about toxic masculinity and its link to violence. Because I think ultimately, the main two villains of the story are Brett and then Michael Fassbender's character, Steve. Like, they're the two villains, and they're the ones that kind of cause everything. Because even, like, you know, with the rest of the kids, they are intimidated by Brett. Like, they don't want to really necessarily do anything that's happening, but Brett is the one that's kind of influencing them to do it and stuff like that. So that's, like, I think what's kind of happening. But again, because of the awful representation that's on the surface, that message, you kind of have to do a bit of digging to get to it, which you shouldn't have to. It should just be what's there on the surface straight away. You shouldn't have to wade through this filth to be able to see some decent story. So yeah, so that was my own little ramble. But for yourself, like, Rebecca, what do you think about that? Like, do you think there is something more, or is it just awful representation and that's it? There's, like, it's just too reductive of a story for there to be anything actually positive from one. It Yeah,
I think one of the things that disappoints me most actually is the director pretending that this is ambiguous. So there's a book by a fantastic book by a journalist called Owen Jones that's called Chavs: The Demonization of the Working Class, and in there he talks about Eden Lake and touches on, he requested an interview with the director and the director declined on the basis of that he didn't want to impose any authorial interpretations and that the film should have a widely divergent reaction, which to me is just, it really is.
Washing your hands of it.
And I think, you know, for me, what really makes me angry is that reading this as a horror film, I do see that our empathy should be with Steve and Jenny. You know, time and time again, the point of view is given to them, the empathy is given to them, you know, all the scenes of, like, the wedding ring and them, you know, cuddling and having, you know, all their scenes are very soft. Whereas, you know, if we talk about the representation of the teenagers, then, you know, it's almost like a checklist of, you know, kids on bikes, you know, kids drinking, kids with dogs on chains. It feeds into, like, very reductive stereotypes, you know, and it almost animalizes the teenagers. You know, and it's not one redemptive character either. So it's very much they're a collective, you know. And if we look at the parents as well, you know, again, it's parents who slap their children, they drink, they argue. It's all boiled down to this real bare bones, like, negative stereotype, where, as I think when we look at the couple, it's like, again, I've said, you know, we're always in their perspective. We've got that opening that's given to them, you know. Jenny reminds me of Miss Honey and Matilda with, like, her pretty dress and all the children around her. It's all very angelic and the children are very submissive. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of juxtaposed, isn't it, with that scene at the pub, you know, where we get some really horrific language from Steve. And while I dislike both characters, I do reserve a special feminine for Steve. He's so entitled. And he's so judgmental as well. You know, he talks about how the child needs a good slap. And, you know, at one point he says, oh, another pint of wife beater, which is just the most offensive. It's the most offensive thing. And it's that language again that I was talking about at the top. It's very sensationalist language, which is what we see in the likes of the Daily Mail. And it's what it does, I think, is it steers us towards binaries. It paints broad strokes. So it's almost like, I feel like the director is encouraging us to laugh along with them rather than to critique them, you know? And it's this laughing downwards you know, like at one point Steve I think imitates the people he sees in the pub when they're in the bedroom together. So it's almost a laughing downwards, which is just, it's so offensive.
Exactly. And there's so many great, like, just, yes, I'm just like, again, I'm just like so happy that you came out to talk about this one, because everything you're saying is just spot on. But yeah, there's so much there. And I think that's actually a very good point that you said, what the director's clearly kind of driving us to do, because I think maybe it was what I brought to it on my rewatch, was I was looking for those kind of more of a nuanced take. Maybe that's why I was
you
hoping
want to make
there was
sense
something
of
there,
it,
because like otherwise it's exactly, that's probably what it was, like, you know, I'm just like, no, bad bell, it's not there, it's not there at all. But I definitely do think that there is, in a better film, there is a story about toxic masculinity and the cycles of violence with the characters of Steve and Brett, because it's really them at loggerheads with each other and everyone else is just caught up in their waves. And I think in a better movie, there's a story there, but that gets lost in everything else. And like, because you do see moments like later in the film, particularly I think as things start to get more intense with the type of basically the torture scenes and the killing scenes, you can see the rest of the group are kind of calling Brett out. They're kind of going, no, this is too much. We shouldn't be doing this. But he pushes them forward and he's kind of going, oh, well, I didn't do it. I, you know, this was recorded. It's you that was doing it, you know, because he's like a manipulative, I think he's like supposed to be like propped up as like a manipulative type of cult leader type character. And it's like, that could be an interesting story if it wasn't under this terrible representation of working class people. Like, oh, it's frustrating.
It
That's really,
I wanted to like
pick
up
angering.
On that point that you've made there, Belle, about the group and this idea of like peer pressure and the reality of being in a gang, because I think this is something this film's also attempting to explore. But again, it really paints it in broad strokes. So I think you know, in these kinds of social settings, you know, young people have got a lot of displaced anger. They're not feeling understood. You know, being in a gang and having a ringleader that comes with a lot of pressure, doesn't it? And I think, you know, Brett makes everybody complicit through involving everybody in the violence. And there's a reality there of gang culture and how, you know, in reality, a lot of young people do fall into that. And, you know, the map that can take you on and how easy it is to become a part of something like that, because you want to be part of a community, a social group, you know, but that might not be a reflection of who you are. And to almost tar everybody with that same brush, which is what this film really feels like it does, is problematic. And I think it's notable that the death of Adam happens off screen, you know, so we don't get that empathy. We don't get to see that moment. And, you know, I think when the kids find Cooper later on and turn on Brett, we get a brief mention that Brett's mum may have been in prison. So, you know, we've got that as well, and him contending with, you know, his not only his social life, but his family life at home. But it's my problem with it is that those sort of more human issues aren't considered and they're not put forward on the screen.
Exactly. And before I bring you in on that one, Alice, as well, like, I think, like, and I think it's a point you kind of touched on earlier as well, Rebecca, but it's kind of like so much of what this film is portraying is not portraying the context around these situations. Because, like, you know, yes, there can be issues of violence in various communities. That just happens there. But a lot of the time, the reason it's happening is because certain communities don't have support structures. They don't have, like, even, like, you know, in my own little town, which is just like a small kind of suburb of Dublin, there's like nothing for young people to do. There's no amenities, there's nothing. So the only thing that young people do is go drinking on the beach or go drinking in the fields. Because if you don't give other things for people to do, you're kind of forcing them into a pigeonhole. And then it comes back to the government going, oh, there's a problem with young people and drinking. Well, do you think why? Like, you know, and I think that's what this film is like lacking. It's lacking a lot of that type of context. And I want to know what you think about that there, like how like angering was a lot of this for you as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly some of the points that I wanted to kind of bring up is the bit when you have that kind of brief mention of Brett mentioned about his mum being in prison. And it's like, again, even that feeds into the stereotype of like these kinds of youths are like this because of their parents go to prison and they're alcoholics and they're just out with their mates all the time and drinking at the pub. And it's, again, it's one of those awful stereotypes that just, yeah, that feeds into like the working class. And there's so many instances like that, like throughout the film, which is just like, it's just awful. And again, yeah, it's like, it's still kind of, it feels like it's a relevant kind of conversation even now, where like you were saying, like we are surrounded, I think, in pretty much nearly every country throughout the UK and throughout probably getting onto like lots of parts of the world as well, where governments are just making us fall apart and not giving youths like infrastructure to go and do things, to have this outlet. And so they've got, well, there's nothing else to do. Like, I didn't have anything else to do when I was a teenager, apart from meeting up in the park and drinking WKD. Like, there was nothing else to do. I just want to know what was your deal, James Watkins? What was your message you were trying to say with this movie? Because it feels like there is only one, and that is that like the working class are awful and violent and they're gonna kill you if you want to go and lie on the beach near them. Like,
like exactly. There's just like, I think that's the burning question, is like, what was the intent from this film? And it looks like my camera is doing some weird wonky things, so I'm just gonna ignore that and continue talking. Maybe it's only on my end. But yeah, no, watching it, you're just wondering like, what, like, what's the intent of this? Like, you know, what, and, you know, this is something that in my, like, main series, the Why Horror series, one of the questions that kind of comes up a lot, like, does there need, you know, authorial voice? And, you know, can you divorce, you know, like, you know, the concept of the death of the author and stuff like that? And, you know, does there need to be necessarily a point to a film, or can art just be art for art's sake? And it's a tough question. And I think that's one of the ones that I'm applying to this film as well, because I'm just like, you know, does it necessarily have to be a point that he's trying to make? Maybe not. But is there a danger in having this bad stereotype representations? Yes. And I think author, directors, creatives are responsible for what they're portraying. Like, you know, if you have to stand over it and say, justify why you put it there. And if this author, as you said, is like declining interviews and all this type of shit, it's because he knows that there's no actual justification and it's like problematic, but he's just going, oh no, there, I don't want to have an authorial voice and just let people decide. No, fuck
yeah,
you,
he wants to pull the cause and then run away. Like, that's what it feels like. Yeah
exactly. No, there was a little point I was going to make. What was the point I was going to make? I don't know. COVID brain fog. It's gone. Okay. But yeah, actually, I think just like putting aside the annoying and frustrating representation in this film, as like a horror film itself, and like, do you think there are any kind of actual genuine kind of successful set pieces that make it work as a horror film, or is it almost impossible to focus on those kind of aspects because of the filth that you're having to watch it through? Yeah, and you know,
I think that the violence, like the kind of, let's say, the torture scenes are like, they do make you wince and they do make you squirm a bit. And I think those bits are really good. If we kind of take away everything else that kind of surrounds it. But then it's also you know, this movie came out around about the time when torture porn was in its heyday, really. So it's also like it barely even touches compared to what was out at the time. You're just like, well, okay, a bit of barbed wire, that's fine, that's nothing. But I do, you know, I do like that as a kind of in that kind of like horror aspect of the movie. I think that the violence is very good. It feels very realistic. You know, I'll give it that, and that's probably about it.
Yeah, like I think for me, like the violence that is on display in screen, I think definitely falls under that kind of category of violence for violence sake. Like that's kind of what it kind of it captures, that type of thematic ambience, I guess. That's not the right word, but I'm running with it. But other than that, and I think that, and then there's the one bit where Jenny is running and you just see her foot go down on like that, two times watching it, that one just makes me go, because it's like feet and like nails and feet and just body horror. Yeah. No, every time. But for yourself, Rebecca, like, do you think there's anything like from an actual kind of, I guess, film making perspective, do you think there's anything that kind of actually does well, even when the story and everything surrounding it is just a pile of flaming garbage?
This is so hard for me to answer, because for me the horror of it is seeing myself is and my identity demonized. That is where the horror for me comes from, I guess. You know, I think you said at the earlier on, Belle, that we all recognize people like Jenny and Steve. So I guess that is a good portrayal in a sense, that I do recognize those types of people. And yeah, I think, I guess, you know, in terms of how it's beat out, there are some good set pieces. Like, I think there's an early scare at the beach where they're in the tent and it's actually Steve. But for a moment you go, oh, could that? Yeah.
Oh yeah, jump scare.
You know, and Jenny hiding on top of the porta cavern. So there are some ingredients there that are very tense and for a horror film. But for me, I can't divorce it.
You can't divorce it. And I think it comes back to kind of like what I was saying earlier, that there is, as you said, there's ingredients for something that is actually making a point, that's like having a strong commentary, but it gets lost under these broad stroke representations. And even when you're talking about like the, you know, so the character of Steve, like there's even a moment earlier in the film, I think it's before they get to the beach, like when they're on their drive and his character says the line of, oh no, this is our last chance to see it before it gets taken over by the developers. And you can tell that in the film's perspective, the only reason that line is there is to go, oh, Steve is a nice guy who cares about this environmental thing, so we have to care about him. Whereas you could actually be making a point about gentrification and how these the reason that we see a lot of these cycles of violence in these type of communities is because people are being displaced by cities and gentrification and governments kind of going, hey, this has been a community for a long time. We don't care. We're going to just build an entire gated community for people from the city to move to. And like there's so much potential for it to actually be a strong like kind of social commentary, but it loses it in the mire of what it's portraying on screen. And it's just really frustrating.
Steve's already such a privileged guy, you know, if you bruise his ego a little bit, or if, you know, you let his ties, you know, the smallest thing, he just abuses his position of power, and he takes it so personally. It everything's just an opportunity to just exploit his position. And he does it with his Ray-Bans.
And I think even like Jenny pokes at him a little bit with that as well. Like there's scenes when they're in the hotel in the bed, and J- Jenny's like, oh, you know, go down and tell them to be quiet. And he's like, no, I'm not going to. And he's like, are you a man or a mouse? So she's even like poking into like making him go and like do these things and make it, you know, make mention all these things about, you know, you're not being a man. Like, go on, go and say something to them. Go and talk to them. Go and tell these kids off. And so I guess there's some bits of that where like that makes Steve's character want to go and like show off and like peacock around in front of Jenny, just to kind of like prove that he is manly and he will protect her. Because like at the beginning of the movie, Jenny is like this like pathetic little like flower that you feel like you could just trample on. Like, just like, I was like, she's just awful. Like she kind of is gets a little bit stronger, I guess, near the end, but she's still like a little pathetic person where she kind of like needs that man to like protect her and like, yeah. So she definitely, I think she has a hand at it as well to kind of,
yeah, she's like a Quentin Blake illustration. That's how I think of her.
Yes,
and I do love that scene, so where Steve's in his Range Rover, his Jeep, and the kids are on their bikes, and they sort of outrun him, and his fancy Jeep can't get him to where their bikes can get. I love that.
There's, I think we've kind of like, for this film itself, we kind of said the most of kind of, we got our anger out. We kind of said the most of what we could. We could spend another hour talking about how angering it is.
We haven't got to the ending yet.
Like, this is true. So yeah, I think we need to wrap up with that. And I think actually, so very good point. Thank you for reminding me. bleak of bleak endings, which is why I think it's a good pairing in a way with the second film we will be bringing in, but in a very different way. But with this one, I think, and again, actually, yes, this is one of the points I wanted to touch on, again, it shows the potential of some type of solid story there, because there's that moment where the unfortunate horrors of what is ever happening to Jenny is happening, and you see kind of Brett, like, he kind of tries to stop the dad taking Jenny in. He's kind of like, even that is too much for him, and he's kind of going, no, don't stop. And then the dad pushes him off, and then there's that moment where he's just kind of looking in the mirror, and it could be a moment of kind of showing like self-reflection and how this is a cycle of violence and toxic masculinity. But then it doesn't push it. It just kind of shows him putting the glasses on, going, I'm cool shit. And it's like, oh. And also, there's that one really disgusting line that the dad that says it, of like, we look after our own, or we protect our own, which, again, in another film, there could be kind of like a strong communal aspect there. But in this film, it's clearly shown to, again, animalize this community and animalize these people and just show them as not having any morals whatsoever and stuff like that. So I want to know what both of your thoughts are on just the end sequence before we jump into Speak No Evil. So I'll lead with yourself there, Rebecca.
I just wanted to first just quickly touch and echo Alice, you mentioned it before, the triumphant nature of Jenny killing Paige, who she just mows down. The film invites us to feel jubilant at this. You know, she's not monsterized in that moment. Mm. The idea is that this is deserved. And I think, you know, we see her lament from after that event. So it's this idea that she's somehow superior because she's capable of empathy. But to the ending then, you know, I noticed actually this time that I hadn't noticed before, the song Respectable is being played at the pub. So it's an echo of that respect the gender thing. And it made me think, God, if there is a scraping of the absolute barrel to try and find a message somewhere in this film, could it possibly be that it's a film about respect and who receives respect, who's in need of it and who gives it, and where respect lies? So that's a question out there, I guess. I think, you know, the tragedy of the working class families is kept off screen, you know, it's off camera, you know, and I think because the film doesn't give those empathetic moments, it is really encouraging us to emote with Jenny. And we hear as well about the mistrust of the police, which is often a factor in the working class community, who are very often targeted by police. And there is that air of mistrust. So, you know, that's in the mix as well. And then we've got the treatment of Brett by his dad, which again is very stereotypical. And then to that ending, you know, we've got the glasses and the deleting of the evidence. So, like you say, a potential redemptive arc there. But then it just slips into this territory of nihilism, and, you know, there's no lessons been learned, there's no regret, you know, it is just almost dehumanizing Brett.
Yeah, definitely. There's even like the moment that, as you touched upon, Bill, where you kind of feel that Brett is going to try and stop his dad from doing it, and then it's that moment of when his dad hits him and then tells him to go to bed, where he completely switches. And I think it feeds in again to that, like, the same kind of stereotype of, you know, these kids get abused by their parents, and you know, so this is why they act like that, because that's what they've been brought up with. You know, it's that like nature versus nurture thing. And in this case, it's like, it's nurture, like their parents are awful, so the kids are awful. And is interesting that, yeah, they did that switch, and they could have very easily had Brett, after he'd been hit, to be like, no, dad, stop it. And like, you know, maybe hit his dad back, and then trying, like, not that Jenny really deserves it, but try and help Jenny to get out and try and put forward a good message to the audience. But yeah, they just don't. They just kind of be like, yeah, he's probably going to do it again, you know, and like, even though all of his friends are dead, like, you know, like, yeah, they really lost the mark there at the ending, where they could have done something like slightly profound.
Exactly.
They just let it all fall apart.
Which I think is a very good summation of the film. There's just so many moments where it just lets it fall apart, like, because when I remember like seeing that Twitter thread of so many people seeing that this was one of those films that was really affecting, it's something that I'm just wondering, what perspective were people coming to this from? Like, was it affecting like it was for your, like, you know, the more empathetic people who come from like working class situations, who basically see the demonization of themselves and people they know? Or was it more of a just people who have that stereotype in their head of, oh, this is what the working class are like, and it was affecting because I'm seeing my fears played out? And it's like, it's one of those things where you just, and that's kind of almost what's scary about people who say the film is one of their favorite films, because I'm kind of just like,
in his book, Owen Jones interviews a few people, and some people say after they saw this film they were pro death penalty. So, you know, don't underestimate the power of cinema. And that's where it comes back to the social messaging, and like you said, Belle, 100%. There is a responsibility here.
Yeah.
Ooh, that is grim. speaking of grim, we'll move on to an equally grim film. Exactly. Because I think we kind of said as much, and thank you for bringing in the ending there, Rebecca, because I probably would have just been like, we've done enough. But no, we had to talk about that as well. But no, we're going to bring it into Speak No Evil as well. And actually, there was one point when you were talking about the kind of, I guess, the relationship between Steve and Jenny and Eden Lake, which I think is a kind of also a good kind of potential segue into Speak No Evil. But you were talking about how so much of what Steve is doing is relating to his bruised ego. And I think that is kind of another thing that's a big recurring theme within Speak No Evil, is ego and how you are perceived, and wanting to be seen as a man's man, which is really the character of Bjorn throughout the film of Speak No Evil. But yeah, so to any of my listeners who may not have seen Speak No Evil again is a Danish film directed by Christopher Tarptup, and main characters are Bjorn and Louise with their little daughter Agnes. They go on a family holiday to, I believe it's Tuscany or somewhere in Italy. And basically they meet this Dutch couple, which is Patrick, Karen, and a young boy, Abel. And effectively they kind of seem to hit it off on this trip. They go home to Denmark and then they get an invitation to come spend a weekend.
Who does that?
With like, this random Dutch couple.
Yeah, I know.
Like, and then they go and shit just goes from there. Yeah, shit gets real.
Yeah.
But it's just like, but coming back to kind of the commentary on like ego and wanting to be perceived a certain way, there is that moment in when they're in Tuscany where I think they're going to a restaurant or they've left a restaurant. But there's one bit where basically Agnes realizes she's left her little bunny and Bjorn goes on this entire like hunt across the entire walk they've been on, finds it and brings it back. And then Patrick is like building the foundation for this weird little bromance, kind of talking about, oh, you're such a hero. You're such a good man for finding the doll, like, you know, instead of just leaving it and buying a new one. And, you know, Bjorn just like gets so like, oh, yeah, I am the man. I am good. Yeah. My wife never tells me I'm good. So this is nice to hear it. And like, I want to know what you kind of just that initial like interaction to the character of like Bjorn and maybe even just like the initial family relationships, but like what were your first kind of feelings when you came across these characters when you were watching the film? And I'll go for yourself, Alice, first.
I mean, yeah, they set up the characters perfectly because they are completely different couples. They're from each end of the spectrum. You've got Bjorn and Louise, who are quite timid really, and you know, very nice people. They would do anything for you, like Bjorn going off to find a Ninnus, the bunny rabbit, and will hunt high and low for it. And then you meet Patrick and Karen, who seem to be confident, and Patrick stands up in the party that they're having and does an announcement in front of all these people, and you can kind of see Bjorn and Louise being like, oh, these are the kind of people that like we want to be and we want to be friends with. And yeah, like in the first kind of like 5-10 minutes, you know exactly the dynamics between these four people like perfectly. They do it so well, I think.
Yeah, and what do you think there, Rebecca? Like, what was your initial reactions to these characters when you were first introduced?
Well, I like that you've intertwined it with that ego point, because on that I do agree, but I think Bjorn's maybe having more of like a masculinity crisis. In a way, I think Bjorn, I actually empathize a little bit with him in that he seems to hate modern life. So he hates tech. He hates team building. I'm on board with that. I really am. Yeah. And I think he wants this like simpler, going back to more of the present, simpler life, you know. And he definitely sees something in Patrick, and Patrick definitely hooks. I think Patrick's someone who uses that hook that he sees in whoever he's going after and identifies that. And in Bjorn, that's what he's identified, you know. He tells Patrick about the wild thing inside that he keeps in chains, doesn't he, you know? And I think that Louise is, well, yeah, she's timid. I think she's someone who's very rule orientated. You've got to keep things together, though. It's like, because almost Bjorn needs to kick up the arse, doesn't he? Whereas like Louise is, she's got to be that person that things have got to work and she's got to look after, you know, the family. But I'd get this sense of Bjorn feeling quite choked by all these rules and this stiffness and, you know, almost a sense of like mild depression in him, like and regret. He talks about he's tired of smiling all the time, so he's had to put this facade on. And there's that moment when they get the postcard and she says, oh, it might be too long to spend with people they don't know when just her and Bjorn are alone. But then he actually does something quite, I think it's slightly toxic, by bringing that card out in the group setting and being like, well, what do we all think? Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's a very telling moment that speaks to the tension in their relationship. Yep. So yeah, I think it sets that off quite nicely where again, I think we know people like Louise and Bjorn that are together. Maybe the fizzle's gone out, you know, just the everyday life.
If it was ever there. Because I think it's
a real point. Things feel a little bit better for a while, but then it's, you know, back to reality.
Exactly. And actually, I think I like that point you talked about, how, like, you know, you feel that Bjorn is having this crisis of masculinity, and it's like, you know, there's elements of his character that wants to go back to a simpler time. And I'm just like, that. I think that's actually just set off a light bulb in my head. But I'm just like, I think that's probably really related to his crisis of masculinity, in that he wants to go back to a simpler time where the man had all the say. I think there's that element. I think that's possibly what part of it, and maybe that's the portrayal of the character of Louise as well. As you said, he feels choked because she's a modern woman who kind of lets her thoughts be known, and he's like, maybe he wants to actually go back to a simpler time where the woman doesn't make a sound and it's just like, it, you know, a classic woman, that type of thing. Maybe there's an element of that. I'm not sure. I could be speculating, but that's what where my brain
went. And I think, you know, this film, a lot of it's about communication. And, you know, if they'd have just communicated with one another, you know, maybe they'd have split up. A lot of this would have happened.
Yeah,
exactly. 100%. I'm just like, I think that is the true message of this film. It's like, maybe you should just split up.
Yeah.
But it's something that there's a joke I make on pretty much every episode of my Why Horror series, where I talk about, I find most rom-coms to be horror movies because it's kind of about, like, you know, monogamy and lack of communication, which is both horrific things to me. But I kind of think Speak No Evil, you know, is kind of what happens after the camera stops rolling in the rom-com. You know, they've pushed it further because it's just, once you just are that bad at communicating, it's just gonna get worse. But yeah, there's so much. But going back to that dinner party scene, yes, I think that action from Bjorn is so, like, underhanded, and it really just shows that he doesn't have any respect for what his wife thinks or what she says, and he wants to kind of force he doesn't have any respect for what she says or what she thinks, but he also doesn't, again, have any, like, ability to be able to actually say that or to kind of express his own opinion. So instead of, like, kind of going no and articulating why he thinks it might be good, he agrees, and then just in the dinner party setting goes, I'm gonna get other people to say it, and it's not my problem then. It's like, what a dick move. But also, they're friends. You're shitty friends to say, oh, it would be rude to say no. What? No, he says yes to that random invitation. Like, it's a postcard as well. It's so weird and antiquated. Like, no,
yeah, send a WhatsApp.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I know Bjorn doesn't like tech, but come on. But actually, again, maybe that was Patrick's, you know, Patrick knows he doesn't like tech, so goes, hey, instead of sending a text message, I'm going to send a postcard. Yep. It's going to be so romantic, and Bjorn is going to like that.
I think that's it, definitely. I think Bjorn probably, I don't know, I always got, like, a little bit of a feeling that Bjorn probably has a little bit of a crush on Patrick as well, and, like, and he wants to be that kind of man. And so, yes, for Patrick to send the postcard, like, I didn't even think about that. That's a great point. For Patrick to send the postcard and for Bjorn to be like, oh, he's like, he's listened to me. And, like, he knows I don't like technology. And he sent me a postcard. He's like a traditional man. Like, but, please, let's go and stay
exactly.
with
him. But actually, that point you're making about, like, you know, how he kind of is attracted to Patrick or what Patrick represents, I kind of think that, like, is something the film is, like, whether it's intentionally doing or not, I don't know, but I think it is happening. But it is a real accurate portrayal of a type of man, particularly a type of incel man. Because a lot of masculinity, particularly toxic masculinity, you know, everything about, oh, you know, we do this because this is what women like and shit, like, it's all about performing for other men. It's not about actually what do women like. It's about, this is what we think women like because this is what other men see as desirable in each other. And it's so weird how homoerotic toxic masculinity is. And I'm just like, if so many of these men just, like, took the blinkers off, they'd kind of realize there's something bubbling under the surface. What it is, I don't know, but it's
weird. Like, this, the scene where they're at the restaurant and Bjorn sees the other couple dancing, and then he gets up with Louise and tries to imitate it. It's so cringy.
Cringe.
Oh yeah.
So cringe and uncomfortable.
He wants it so badly. Oh. Like, he really, but what? it's so inorganic.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's so uncomfortable, but like, again, and I think that such that scene in particular, because then what it leads to as well is the kind of different type of sexual encounters you see happen in the house when they're staying in the house. And I think they're all interconnected with that dance sequence. But I think it's really interesting in showing where these different characters are coming from, because there are, in society, people who come from different perspectives. Like, there are some people who kind of think that any display of affection or sexuality in public is a no-go. You shouldn't do it. It should only be for behind closed doors, because putting it on display in public is wrong. And then, and whereas I'm just like, as a very bisexual, polyamorous, horny switch, I'm just like, no, no. Like, once, you know, once you're not like having sex in public, you're kind of fine, like, you know. But it's interesting seeing the different perspectives these characters have of where what they represent, different societal views on things, which I think is what this film overall is doing, is it's talking about, one, people are shit at communicating, but also like, they're different social perspectives mixed with shit communicating just leads to really awkward, at best awkward social situations, at worst really kind of dangerous situations. But I want to know what both of you think about that, about kind of what the film's kind of portrayal of possibly the different societal kind of, I guess, views or perspectives that are going on. And yeah, I'll go for you.
So
first,
I think, yeah, I think there's all that's bubbling under the surface. And I think, you know, particularly, well, I say on the first time watch, parenting, but I guess you get to find out that some people aren't real parents. But, you know, that whole situation of Louise at the dinner table saying, you know, don't speak to my daughter that way, you know, she's my child and I'll parent her the way I see. And then seeing the whole scene with Abel play out and then trying to step in and not realise that actually they're critiquing someone on something that they wanted to be treated like that way themselves. It's very complex, because in that scene, I am glad that they're speaking up for Abel, because it's an absolutely agonising scene, you know. And you can see that they're not a confrontational couple. But yeah, I think there's a lot of that. And, you know, the vegetarianism and that not being respected, but the Louise just going along with it, you know, the different way that space is used in the film, and particularly the bathroom and the bodily space and how much that's invaded. It speaks to a lot of different attitudes. It's like when I first met, I'm blanking on the Patrick and what's the well, yeah Patrick when I first Karen, meet Patrick and couple. Karen, well, particularly Karen, I was like, oh, this woman's a breath of fresh air. Like, she's like up for a good time. She's not, you know, she hasn't tidied the house up too much, so it's like she's just very free and easygoing. But yeah, it doesn't really turn out that way. And I guess, you know, the idea of the babysitter as well is also interesting. That's another moment for me. Well, I mean, there's just, you can't move for red flags in this film. But, you know, I think it's obviously allegorical, isn't it? You know, it's an idea that if you don't speak up, bad things will happen. But this idea of we will leave our child with a babysitter, you know, who we don't really know, and them feeling pushed into a blaring of what their boundaries would normally be, to me is interesting, out of politeness. It's like, you wouldn't normally do that, but in this situation you feel fenced in and you don't want to. It's that social cues that you were talking about, Belle, and this idea of being polite. And, you know, here in the UK, I think we're very well known for being polite, and so that resonated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why Speak No Evil was such a successful film in the UK, because UK audiences were just like, oh no. Oh yeah. no. I'm just like, how far would I have allowed this to go? Because, and I think there's an odd of overlap with Ireland as well, because we're, as a culture, we're very much influenced both by our colonizers, the UK, and America, where we were put into indentured servitude. Both countries influence us. So our culture is a weird mishmash of everything, but we have a lot of that as well, of that forced politeness of not offending. And like, I think the film does such a good job of navigating that territory. And I want to know what you kind of think on that point, Alice, like, as well, like, you know, that whole thing that's going on of politeness and social cues. Like, what were your kind of thoughts, like, watching the film?
I mean, it cover it so perfectly. It gets to a point where it's a bit ridiculous. But especially like at the start, where I'm just like, I think that there's so many situations where I would have just gone along with it as well and not said anything because of that fear of being impolite. And it's so that I think, like you're kind of saying, that's why lots of people loved it, especially in the UK, because the amount of conversations I've had with people where I've been like, at what point would you have left? Like, and lots of people would have said, I probably just wouldn't have gone. But it's like, yeah. I was like, you went. At what point would you have left? And I think my cutoff point has to be when they're actually leaving, and then Agnes is like, I can't, screw the bunny,
and then we'll get you another one. Like, oh well, like, no,
we'll go in. Yeah.
Exactly, but I think that scene in particular, it's like, one, it's obviously a callback to Bjorn being the hero and going to get it earlier, but I think it's also linking back to particularly Louise and her view as herself as like a mother and a parent and stuff like that. And I think it's like, you know, so much of what was their interactions with Patrick and Karen was like her putting her foot down of like, this is how I'm parenting my child. And I think, like, you know, in that car scene, there was obviously a bit of pushback between Bjorn and Louise, but I think ultimately it was kind of, how are we parenting our child? And it, part of it was, we're getting her, you know, it's a lesson or something like that, rather than going, oh, money is frivolous and we'll just buy you a new one, we're going to go back and get her actual toy because it teaches, I guess, value for things you own or something. There's probably, that's going on in their heads, and that's why they go back. And then it just,
I wonder as well, now that you're talking about yeah. it, I just wondered, is there any possibility that Bjorn wants to go back because he wants more time with Patrick. Mm-hmm. He wants them to be pulled back in again, mm-hmm. so he can have more time with Patrick. It's almost like a subconscious thing of wanting to return there.
Oh, totally. And also definitely. I think the entire time you can clearly tell that Bjorn wants a foursome. Like, he wants that to happen. Oh, yeah. He wants that to happen. Like, why else would you bring your family to now? He wants that to happen with this couple he finds so endearing. And the entire, so much of the film is just him very disappointed it's not happening.
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's even the bit when Bjorn and Louise are having sex and Bjorn sees that Patrick is looking at them, and he carries on with it, and he's like, actually looks like he quite likes that Patrick is watching him. So, you know, he is definitely well up for a foursome. That is why he's there. Probably a threesome.
Yeah, he probably actually doesn't want Louise to be involved, because he doesn't actually have any affection or care for her at all. Yeah, he's probably like, okay, Louise, you go home and I'll just stay here and live out my triad fantasy. But no, like, one of the other scenes in, like, there's so many scenes in this film, like, that again are like examples of either red flags or just awkward social situations. Like, there is one scene I think that really stands out, like, and again, I think coming back to what you were saying, Louise, earlier, with that scene where they actually kind of criticize like Patrick and Karen over how they're treating Abel, like, that isn't like the like, that's not the first time we see that type of treatment. Like, earlier in the film, it's at like the slides, like, you know, where Agnes, like, and again, it's this really interesting thing of like, it is some kind of commentary on the way different people parent their children. Because I think there is this element of like, it kind of seems that like, you know, Bjorn and Louise have kind of raised a bit of an entitled child who's kind of like, I have rights to this at all times. I don't want to share, and that type of thing. And then with Abel, like Patrick slaps him. And you can see Louise and Bjorn are uncomfortable, but they don't say anything because they're, again, it's that weird politeness of like, well, we don't want to criticize how other people, we disagree, but we don't want to criticize how they parent their own child. But then it's all about the lines. Like, it gets to a point where they can't put up with it anymore. And it's, yeah, I want to know what both of you think about how successful the film is, portrays that type of, how far will people allow their boundaries, I guess, to be pushed before they actually say, no, this is enough. Like, I want to know what both of you think about that. And I'll go to yourself first, Alice.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've been in situations before where even as probably in like a public place or something, and I've seen a child probably not be treated in a way that I would like to see a child be treated. And it is that thing of like, oh, should I say something about that? And then you're like, oh no, I probably don't want to get involved. I won't. And I think that that's something that, again, lots of people can relate to. Maybe some people have friends who probably don't parent their kids in a way, or even your family, if they've got your like nieces, mm-hmm. nephews, or even like brothers or sisters, where you're like, oh, I wouldn't say that like to my kid. But then, you know, then they, like you were saying, then they do get involved with it, and they do say something, and you kind of feel good that they do say something. You're like, yes, this at this point, this is when you say something, because this poor kid is just doing this lovely little dance. Like, like Abel is just such an angel. Like, how can you just not love him and not want to just support him and like, you know, pick him up all the time. But yeah, they just, I think it, again, like, I think, like we've kind of covered upon, I think this movie just covers the kind of social, like, awkwardness and social politeness so perfectly. It covers how we treat children and the different aspects of how we treat children, like, really well. I don't think there's any point, apart from the kind of ending that we kind of find out, nothing feels too far-fetched until the ending, where you're like, oh no, there's some parents are like that. And there's some points where Karen has like a good point, I don't think she's like mistreating Agnes at some point. I think there's a point where Agnes is laying the table and Karen just says like, oh no, like the knife and fork goes actually like the other way around. And then Louise is like, oh, don't say that. And it's like, but she's just, I don't know. That's how I took it. I was like, oh, it's not actually like saying anything bad to her at the time. She's just telling her how to lay a table. Like, I wouldn't feel bad if someone else said that to my kid. I think that's the only point where I'm like, that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. You hit so much on the nail head there. But yeah, so for yourself there as well, Rebecca, like, you know, how, like, what do you think about how the film does the same, about how it portrays that like boundary pushing and how much people will allow their boundaries?
I think that's one of the
pushed.
Most appealing things about the film is that it feels almost interactive in that sense of putting you in a position, like you said, Alice, the conversations you've had, same as like, at what point would you go, you know, at what point would you do this? You know, it's where are your boundaries. It's like, it's a gradual build of moments, isn't it? A bit like in Eden Lake, which is why I can see them as a good, I'm encouraging people to double bill these films, but you know, they both, you really do.
If you really want to bring yourself down,
I think the films are asking you to assess how you would react, you know, and it starts with those small conflicts, like in Eden Lake on the beach, and then it just builds to extremes. But you know, you've got things like, you know, the shower and that, you know, the bathroom not being respected and him not speaking up. And not only does Louise not bring this up with Patrick, but she doesn't tell Bjorn either. So it's a miscommunication on so many fronts. It's almost like there's a set of boundaries and rules externally, but there's also a very messed up set of boundaries and rules within the relationship. And I think when they're trying to explain why they want to leave, instead of just going, we're leaving now, You know, they really make a big deal out of it, and it's like, actually, they should just go, you know? And because they haven't spoken up earlier, now it actually seems reasonable for Patrick and Karen to say, well, why don't you just tell us? Why don't you just say, you know, why don't you just say you were uncomfortable with that? So because they've, you know, neglected to voice how things make them feel from the beginning, they've in a sense made a rod for their own backs, you know.
Exactly. The film is so masterful that, like, because again, so much of it, I think it is you're following, obviously, you know, Bjorn and Louise. So a lot of it is you're from their perspective. So the film does that masterful job of switching it and kind of just going, again, as you said, Patrick and Karen going, what? Like, you know, this is all news to us. Like, you know, how are we supposed to know there was a problem if you didn't let us know there was a problem? And like, there is an element of truth to that, like, because that comes back to communication. And I think it's like, you know, people aren't mind readers, like, you know, so like, unless you actually kind of like, in general kind of social situations and stuff like that, if unless you actually kind of speak up and say what you're thinking and or like actually proclaim a boundary and that you feel it's being crossed or it has been crossed, someone can't necessarily know that they have. Because like, the thing is, and I think the film is, because it does a good job of having it, because they're obviously two different social cultures, like, you know, and it's like, it does a really good job of that's how it helps portray it. Like, if it had been they were just two couples from the same city, then it wouldn't be as believable that there'd be this much of a lack of understanding of where the other is coming from. But, you know, it could be that Patrick and Karen, all the people that, you know, before you find out who they actually are, but up until this point, it could be that all the people that they know and that they hang out with, this is just how people are. How are they supposed to know that what they're doing is a boundary crossing activity? Because it could be within the boundaries of their current social culture. And yeah, the film does such a good job of navigating those different territories and also just building the tension and the cringe. And it just, the entire time, you're just kind of, it's almost like watching The American Office. You're kind of a little bit like, oh, I'm just like, I'm going to continue watching it, but also, oh, this is just like too much. Like, and it's a different type of torture than what's going on in Eden Lake. Like, you know, it's very different type of torture. But we've all kind of alluded to it at this point. So I think now is kind of a good point to actually bring in kind of the twist and what happens once you kind of realize what's happening. Because, you know, up until the twist, it's really just a bit of a uncomfortable social drama. That's kind of all that's happening. It's kind of just, yeah, it's a bit cringy. It's these couples that don't really, you know, understand what the other is doing. They're equally all shit at communicating, and it's like, what happens when you just throw that together? And then we get the twist, and the twist is basically what happens is when Bjorn is, he goes out, I think it's like the swimming pool or the garage or something like that, and he ends up basically, one, he finds Abel's dead body floating in the pool, but then he also sees the wall of all of these children that is with Patrick and Karen, and it clearly shows that, oh, Abel, one, isn't their kid, and it explains why Abel was mute and didn't have a tongue, but also that they've been doing this for a very long time. It's just picture after picture after picture of these souvenirs of this really morbid situation. That's when you see the number of pictures there, that's when you kind of have to put, like, you know, your like kind of logical hat to the side, because you're just like, could a couple really get away with this for that long, going to the same resort? Because it doesn't seem like it's a different city, like they're going to the same resort, so it's like, after a while, surely the resort people must be suspicious, unless they're in on it as well. Who knows? But it's like that twist happens and you see what's happening. But I think this, again, linking back to Bjorn's one, terrible communication, but also kind of just weird behavior from the start, when he, like, you know, pulls out the postcard at the table and kind of pulls it on Louise. He doesn't let Louise know why they need to leave. He doesn't communicate that. He just says, we need to leave. And again, it's a kind of a flip on when Louise says that they need to leave, she didn't communicate why. The two of them are just shit communicating. And I want to know what you both thought about the reveal and kind of, I guess, the subsequent events afterwards. And I'll go to yourself first, Rebecca.
Okay. I had that same thought about, you know, Bjorn now having the knowledge, you know, almost seeing his fate ahead of him. And from this point on, I agree, it's like it did feel a bit of a social drama. Now it feels like we're on these tracks of inevitability. And, you know, I think... Patrick even gives him a chance in the car by getting out and having a pee and leaving the keys in the ignition, but he doesn't take it. It's so infuriating that moment to me. It's like, come on, now is the time, like you've really got to, and he doesn't. It's like he just resigns himself to what's going to happen. You know, and we get that scene in the car where I don't know if you want me to go this far. Okay, go there.
Go ahead.
So in the car, Bjorn's hit about. Louise is clinging on to Agnes, and you know, the babysitter returns, and Agnes's tongue is cut out, and she's taken away. They're driven to a roadside, and all the time they're like compliant. And I understand that, you know, people freeze sometimes in trauma, so it's very difficult to watch. You know, this idea now that they've got, especially once Agnes has gone, that there's nothing left to live for. And I get the sense that, you know, Louise just wants death at this stage, because she takes her clothes off when asked with no questions. You know, she just does what's asked. It's like, okay, you know, and you get that sort of goosebump moment where Bjorn says, you know, why are you doing this? And Patrick says, because you let me.
Yeah, that was the chilling moment.
So he puts it all back onto them, which is just devastating. And I do value seeing them come together at the end, you know. It made me think for a moment, oh, was there something worth saving there? You know, it's obviously a very heightened, but yeah. And then obviously we get that sort of, as you've alluded to already, Belle, that idea of it being cyclical and the suggestion of this being repeated again, and seeing Agnes with the bunny. Man, that bunny's got a lot to answer for.
Yeah.
The true villain. Yeah,
the true villain of the film.
True villain. And that was, we've gone on to the kind of right at the ending and how it kind of alludes to this is like an ongoing thing. Like, I think right, one of the endings that they had written originally was that right at the end, you will see all of these different couples doing the same things. So kind of this idea that it is a kind of a cult that they're part of, which is, it's kind of interesting, but I'm really glad that they didn't go down that route. I just kind of like that there's just this idea that there's these two evil, well, three evil people, because you know that the babysitter is involved in it, just this kind of small group of people that are just doing this really heinous, awful thing to various different families for years and years. Rather than it kind of being this cult where you're like, oh, okay, so it's a cult.
Yeah.
And he was like, well,
yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
Like the horror of it gets taken away a little bit there.
Exactly. It's interesting. Just like where my brain was just going there when you were saying about how the alternative ending was that it was this more of this kind of seedy kind of network or something like that under, like, yeah, people aren't noticing. I'm like, you know, there could be an allegory that it's a cult, or, you know, potentially it could be kind of commenting on kind of like, you know, the whole kind of like Jeffrey Epstein-esque type of eliteness of society, that there is this weird disturbing underbelly. Like, maybe it could have been doing that. Like, these people can just get away with it because they're and they must be somehow extremely wealthy, because like they don't work, but they also can go on all of these holidays because they're clearly funded somehow, like, you know. So maybe there is a network. I don't know, but yeah, like once you start thinking about it a bit, like you start, like, you know, it starts to unravel a little bit of like, really, how does that happen? So you kind of need to stop yourself and just sit with the kind of social messaging that it's kind of put, or commenting on communication and social messages. But yeah, that ending is just so bleak and nihilistic, but it's in again commenting, like in a comparison to Eden Lake, with Speak No Evil, it's kind of like it's a nihilism that feels like it's been building up to it. You can, it's like a natural progression almost. Like it kind of, it does justify it in a way. And within the world of the film, it makes sense that the ending is so bleak and nihilistic. Whereas with Eden Lake, it was kind of it didn't have to be. They just but yeah, I think like as well, like I wanted to actually bring back in less on the ending, but we kind of touched on the character, but you know, the babysitter character as well. Like I think both, you know, we see him kind of coming in at the ending, but I think when we see him actually introduced as the babysitter originally, I do think there is an interesting, again, kind of commentary on like how, you know, there is this kind of social view that men you don't know are automatically more dangerous. And, you know, the fact that not only is it a man, but this is also a man of color, you know, like, so there's this view that only, you can only trust babysitters if they're women or girls. Like if it's a man, and you know, the fact that this is a man of color, and it shows that Bjorn and Louise have this extra level of distrust. So I'm just like wondering, like, is that intentional to kind of like show that these characters have like kind of their own social biases, or is it just simply we don't feel comfortable leaving our child with any stranger? Like, I want to know what you think about that specific scene. Like, do you think there's something actually more going on, or is it just simply on the surface what it is?
I think that it would have, if it was a woman that turned up, Louise probably would have been like, oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. Because there is that kind of social bias of like, men shouldn't be babysitters. There's even like a whole Friends episode about it, about how ridiculous it is that like, that when like, you know, when Ross is like, a man shouldn't be a nanny. And then like, you know, it's a whole episode. So that's been a thing that's been going on for years and years. So there is always going to be, unfortunately, that social bias. So I think it was definitely intentional for it to be. And like, you know, they even say like, oh, he doesn't speak English, which so there's like this. So Louise is like, well, there's this man in the house looking after my daughter, and he doesn't speak English. And I think, yeah, completely. If it was kind of, if it was a white woman, and they would have been completely fine, I think, 100%.
Yeah, and what do you think on that point?
I agree. I at the time was thinking this is definitely highlighting not just our feelings towards strangers, but our perception of who we other and make strange, you know, in certain societal roles, like looking after children, and you know, that being men, and then, you know, down from that, that being like people of color. And I think who Louise and Bjorn seem to be are people that would hold those kinds of prejudices. So it's a very subtle, it's actually really well done, that because it's not a point and look moment, it's just there. And I think it's really well done.
Exactly. And yeah, I think, yeah, there's just so much this film does really well. Like, it's, yeah, and I think it's like, it's again, it's a nice double bill in comparison with Eden Lake, because Eden Lake is like, makes you uncomfortable for the wrong reasons, whereas Speak No Evil makes you uncomfortable because it's actually just done really well. And so many of those situations, like, even though you're watching it and you're kind of screaming at the TV or the screen, kind of going, what are you doing? But also there's an element of like, actually, I don't know, like, you know, what, because like, again, and I wonder if the film is like possibly commenting on it, or it's like, you know, it's there in the background. But you know, when it comes to how people themselves are wired, you know, everyone has their own different types of communication styles. Like, you know, certain people are like people pleasers, and I think this film is probably more scary to a lot of people pleasers, because so much of this is like, you don't disagree because you want the people you're around to be pleased with you and what, you know, and everything that you're is going on with you. So I'd say people who are, I guess, have more direct communication styles are probably watching this film and kind of going, what the fuck are these idiots doing? Like, what are you doing? Why didn't you just, like, why did you just eat the meat? That is stupid. Like, that is stupid. Like, whereas, like, if you're a people pleaser, you'd probably go, oh, this is making me uncomfortable, but I can't really say it because we're guests here and I don't want to be rude. And it's just like, and then again, later on, Patrick kind of goes when they try to leave and he kind of goes, well, why didn't you just say you didn't want to eat the meat? You didn't have to. I didn't force you to do it. You chose to eat the meat. It's just like, there's the film does a good job of getting your emotions raised.
It does. It does. And did you both know that? And here's a credible twist. Did you both know that the director of Ian Lake has been announced as the director of an English remake of Speak No Evil for Blumhouse?
Oh, I was waiting to bring this up.
I did not know that. Oh, yeah.
You made the perfect tie-in unintentionally.
Oh my god, have we brought this in? Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no, what have I done? My powers are beyond my ability, my reckoning.
It's the most bizarre thing ever because it's not like this is an old movie either. So it doesn't really deserve to be remade. It's not like it's.
But also.
It's not like it's all in Dutch.
It's not a subtitled film, like for most of it. That's so disappointing.
And I think it's either like Ewan McGregor or James McAvoy is playing. James McAvoy I can't remember who he's like playing, but he's in it.
He's probably the Bjorn character. I couldn't see him as the Patrick character. He doesn't have like, I guess, the stature or presence.
No.
Like you could see maybe like Alexander Skarsgård as Patrick, possibly.
Yeah.
Maybe I just want to see more Alexander Skarsgård. That could be it. I'm kind of disappointed in Blumhouse because I normally am kind of I root for what Blumhouse do, but I'm just like, really? Why are you doing that? That's disappointing. But also, that director? Oh no. It's, because again, and the thing is, I know I'll probably watch it anyway.
Maybe we should just all come back together.
But it's going to be yeah, exactly. Do a revisit episode. Yeah. Brilliant idea. And we'll all hate watch this new film and just like rage about it. But I already have an inkling of that specific director is gonna miss all the nuances of what Speak No Evil is 100%. Doing and is gonna just be broad strokes.
Sorry, Belle, sorry.
I don't know what's worse. I am sure that news. But talking about a bleak ending, I think that's a good kind of point to kind of wrap us up on our discussion of these two films, because I think we've talked about all the major talking points that I wanted to bring in on both of them. And I think before I just allow you to kind of say where people can find you and stuff like that, just kind of final thoughts, like, one, would you recommend this as a double bill to people, but also like, what are your feelings on like both films in general? Like, I'm assuming you probably have preferences over which film is your preferred watch. And I'll go first to yourself, Alice.
I mean, I would definitely recommend watching Speak No Evil if you haven't already. It was a movie that when I first watched it, I was like, I am never watching this film again. It really upset me. It was the first movie in a long time that made me cry just from shock factor. But then I've rewatched it quite a few times now because I've covered it on my own podcast as well. And now for this, and the more time as I watch it, the more I kind of enjoy it as a film. And it like, it's obviously it's still upsetting, but, I get more and more out of it every time that I watch it. With Eden Lake, I don't think you really need to watch it at all. I don't think it brings anything to the table. I don't think it's even particularly good just to go and watch like some violence. I think that there's plenty of torture porn movies out there that you can get that out of and a bit better, to be honest. I would pick Speak no evil and not Eden Lake.
Yep, perfect. And I have a feeling that you'll be in agreement, Rebecca, but what are your own the comparison of the two and your
well
preference?
One makes me think and one makes me angry. Can you guess which is which? Yeah, Speak No Evil, really, it really makes me think. And having this discussion with both of you today, it's made me think even more. It's a film that I think has got, you know, increasing returns. So like Alice said, you know, you can, you know, once you know what happens, you can watch how it happens and look for those intricacies. Eden Lake is just a nasty, vile, irresponsible film. So I would not recommend that. But I've really appreciated having the opportunity to unpack it and share feelings with you both today.
Amazing. And, you know, thank you both for coming on to talk about these two, because they're not exactly easy films to kind of sit through or, well, Speak of Evil is, yes, easier, and that's good. So, you know, but they're not exactly like fun watches. But yeah, so thank you both for actually coming on to talk about both of these films with me. I've really enjoyed this chat, and we've talked on a lot of interesting topics. So before I let both of you go, first for yourself, Alice, like, where can people find you, your podcast, and just kind of support the stuff you do?
So you can find me on Twitter with at A Boyd Leslie. You can find Drunken Horror on Twitter and Instagram at Drunken Horror. We have loads of fun episodes coming out. We have one with yourself, Belle, that's at time of recording has just come out, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which was a fantastic discussion, which was great fun. And then we've got another horror musical coming out very soon as well, Little Shop of Horrors. So yeah, we've got some really fun stuff coming out, so come and check us out.
Lovely. And yourself, Rebecca, as well, where can people find the stuff that you have going on, your fingers and all the different pies, and where can they kind of support
left.
Your work?
So shout out first and foremost to Ghouls Magazine. You can find us on Twitter at Ghouls Mag. We've got some really great things coming up, including a panel that I am hosting, which Belle, you are going to be a panelist on. That is on working class representation in horror. So yeah, that's coming up. Also, my Talking Hitchcock podcast, the first episode is going to be released this Friday. So that's the 21st of April. Just not sure when this pod will go out. So 21st of April, first episode. You can find that on Hitch_pod. And you can find my work on Twitter and Instagram at Pendle Pumpkin.
Amazing. Thank you again so much for both of you coming on and jumping into both of these films with me. And I'm happy I was able to give a place for you to get your rage out, Rebecca, because it's always good to, you know, vent and talk about the films that anger us and just to get it out into the ether. So no, thank you both for coming on. I've had such a pleasure. And to my listeners, keep your eyes and ears peeled for future episodes of my podcast. My Why Horror series is ongoing fortnightly on Fridays, and I'm gonna start doing these type of bonus episodes talking about films or maybe just general topics and fortnightly on Wednesdays. And also, I now have merch, link in the bio, please support my pod. And thank you both for coming on, and yeah, goodbye to everyone and to my listeners. Talk to you soon.